Good morning. It's November 14th, 2008. It's a beautiful fall morning in Franklin, Pennsylvania. We're in the historic Hugh Osmer House in Franklin and having a conversation with Carolee Mishner. Mrs. Mishner is much beloved in this community in Franklin, Venango County, in the oil region. She's recognized as the Dean of Oil Historians, General Historians, I might add, and a longtime professional in journalism. And I would say she shares the honor with Bud Pelagi as being the Dean of Journalists who are with us. It's a real pleasure to have you here this morning, Carolee, and welcome.
Thank you, Neil.
All right. We are, of course, in Franklin, a remarkable community. It's a beautiful, still thriving community. It's a wonder to behold in so many respects. It's a small place, and yet over the last 150, 200 years, it's been prosperous for a number of reasons. Much of that prosperity goes back to the oil industry in the 19th century, and that extends up into at least the first half of the 20th century. I'd like to kind of explore that a little bit with you, Carolee, and let's just talk somewhat about the Miller family, for example, Charles Miller, and the impact he had on the Franklin community and in the oil industry in the country, for that matter.
Well, Charles Miller came here really because of the oil. Franklin was a little village with about 900 people, you know, a lot of dirt streets, and, you know, we had an iron factory and a few other things, but basically it was just a little rural village. But it was also the county seat. So that, since it was established as that, that lured some people here. He came here from New York State with the idea of having a little store, and he had what was called the Buffalo Dry Goods Store. But he was very shrewd, very smart. So he was a young man of 22 or 23 when he came here, and he ran the store for a while, but he soon learned that the money to be made was in oil. Mm-hmm. And in so that's where he, you know, put his niche. It was in oil.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's to set the stage here, let's explain to folks the crude oil that his concern ended up refining or processing, that might be the better way for it, was something known as Franklin heavy crude. Much different, actually, than the balance of the crude around here. Could you tell us a little more about that?
Yes, it was much different. It had, you know, 30 to 32 degrees gravity compared to 28 for the other oil that was found around here. And it was a natural lubricant. People used it on their machines as it came out of the ground, actually, you know. And the first well that was drilled here was several months after Colonel Drake's well in Titusville, and a man by the name of James Evans, who lived down just down the street from where we're sitting now, actually, down along French Creek, and he had drilled a water well. He was a blacksmith and drilled a water well, but it always smelled like, you know, crude oil. Mm-hmm. And the water wasn't very good, obviously, that came mm-hmm. out of it. So he finally found somebody that would loan him a little money to make his own tools, and he kicked down his water well deeper to about 72 feet, and he got Franklin heavy crude, when it was what came from the ground. And that was the first of a number of Franklin heavy crude wells that came. The field is quite limited. It's in Franklin, it goes out to Sugar Creek, and it goes up the river just a little ways, and you're going to get that type of oil.
I've read Patchell Run up on French Creek is the upper, right. I suppose that would be the western limit, if
yeah.
you will.
Mm-hmm.
And then over to Two Mile Run,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. It's fairly limited where you're going to find it, but it is. And it was, that was what some of the early refineries were based on. Not most of the early refineries, of course, made illuminants for lamps. And the first refinery that was started here was actually by George Bissell and his partners, and it was over along French Creek, but they were strictly for fuel for lighting lamps. And but there was another small refinery called the Great Northern that started down at the where French Creek goes into the Allegheny River, and they made a lubricant called Hendrix. And a man by the Mr. Hendrix owned it. And they lasted only a short time, and then it was leased to a man by the name of Colonel Street, and he changed the name of the lubricant to Galena because of the lead sulfide that was used in the process of refining this. But it was still a heavy oil, and it was used for that. Well, then that's when Charles Miller came into the picture. He was 26 by then, and he knew that he was going to make his money, or felt he was going to make his money in oil. Mm-hmm. Not drilling oil, but processing it. And he bought it, and while the Colonel Street had been paying Mr. Hendricks $1 a barrel for the rights to use his patent in the manufacturing, Charles Miller was shrewd enough to buy the patent. So he bought the patent from Mr. Hendricks and paid him like $300 a month until he got it paid off, the $6,000 paid off, and that was a shrewd move. And it,
I agree. We tend to forget that part of it. Everybody knows about Charles Miller's great salesmanship talent. But we forget that he did buy that early patent, which allowed him to do what he did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, they had a fire down there, right?
Yeah, they had a fire, and there wasn't too much said about it. We only had a weekly newspaper, and of course they were covering, you know, the whole county and the whole area, and they didn't go into great detail, but they did talk about the fire and how this Franklin's new steam engine from the fire department was pulled by manpower across the bridge that's right down here at the base of the hill, and pulled it across and up to fight the fire, but it was too far gone. But later on, it was around 1912, I think, that somebody did an interview with Charles Miller, and he said that he caused the fire. Because he said he had come back from Omaha with a whole bunch of new orders, and he was all enthused, so he fired the boiler too hot, and it caught the business on fire. But there again, they were certainly limited in space down there. I mean, if you look at the terrain today, you wonder how they had refineries and railroad and a road and everything else between that hill and the creek. So they bought the old Dale Refinery, which was over in the Third Ward of Franklin, but also along French Creek, nice level land, and they had plenty of room to expand. Mm-hmm. So that gave them the opportunity to turn that from a refinery that made illuminants to one that made their lubricating,
galena
oil.
Now, he had some serious investors that took part in that Samuel Dale property construction.
Right. Yeah.
Who were some of those fellows?
Well, John Coon was one of them. A man by the name of Austin was another one. And there was a plumber.
He was a plumber.
Who was related to the Mr. Austin. And they invested in it to help him get the money to move. But but he was a shrewd businessman. In addition to being a super salesman, he was also a shrewd businessman. And by that time, he had turned his little store over to his brother-in-law, Joseph Sibley. And soon Joseph Sibley was also out of the store. And he was into the oil business too. Yeah.
Right. Let's just talk. We'll come back to Charles. The story's so huge, you just can't stop it right there. But this is a natural point to bring in Joseph Sibley a bit more.
Joseph Sibley developed type of signal oil to also be used on railroads, and that is the main place where galena oil was used. Now, it was a lubricant for many other things. I mean, you know, you could use it for any type of machinery, but railroads were the big thing. And railroads were, of course, up and coming all across the nation. Mm-hmm. And that's where Mr. Miller, you know, and that's where Mr. Sibley, they both of them, you know, concentrated their efforts on the railroad. And that's what really made the railroads roll, and it made the company roll, too.
Okay, for a moment, could we recall where Charles Miller's first house was and where Joseph Sibley's big house, the big houses, the first mm-hmm. big houses were. I know Joseph Sibley was right down here where the post office in Franklin is today.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's not the one most people remember as the Joseph Sibley house,
no.
But that was there.
Yeah, he had a large house there, and interestingly enough, when they sold the land to the postal department in the 1920s to build a post office there, they took his house and moved it about a block and a quarter down the street, and it eventually became a rooming house and so forth, you know.
Now gone, unfortunately.
But we do remember Mr. Sibley for building a property called River Ridge.
Yes.
He built a huge stone house at River Ridge, built stone houses for his employees and so forth, and had an experimental farm there for a number of years. But it was all based on the money he made in the oil business. Right. Isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Right. And it comes out, I suppose more with Sibley than Miller, the man was really a farmer at heart.
Yeah, I think a lot of the early industrialists were farmers at heart. They grew up on farms, and they knew farming, you know. And Miller and Sibley together had a stock farm at the edge of Franklin for many years, mm-hmm. raised thoroughbred horses, thoroughbred cattle, and so forth, you know. And they were very good and very generous in their sharing with the other farmers around here, you know. Mm-hmm. They provided them many times with good bloodlines in their, you know, for
right.
their...
good stock.
Yeah, good stock.
Good genetic
so,
stock.
Yeah. And Mr. Sibley particularly brought in many people to talk to the farmers in the area about farming, about how to prune trees, how to plant things, and how to diversify their crops. And, you know, he hosted many large gatherings for farmers.
Mm-hmm. I like to think of these fellows as... the early Penn State Agricultural School. It just wasn't
right.
called Penn State
yeah.
at the time.
Uh-huh.
They played that role.
At one time when a man from Penn State was here, just when they were starting that cooperative extension work and so forth, and he said, if every county had somebody like Mr. Sibley, you wouldn't have to have us, really. So basically, that's what he said, you know, because he did so much. Yeah.
Let's go back to Charles. He's such a huge... person,
yeah,
huge presence when he was alive, and he still is today, actually, in Franklin. I think it's the Alpaca House or that property where he had his first home. I could be wrong in that. We both know that he eventually went up there into Miller Park and developed it. Let's talk about Miller Park. It's a special residential area. Franklin has beautiful residential streets, but the Miller Park is the crown jewel to the whole thing.
Yeah, Miller Park used to be called Galena Hill because they drilled oil on it. And then eventually they decided that in the early 1900s that we needed some places for more homes, and they developed that up there. And it was Mr. Miller and his children that developed it. You know,
most of those big houses are somehow related to him.
A lot of them are related to him. Yeah,
right.
You know, if you go back far enough, they're related to his family or friends and people that were in business with him, and so on and so forth.
Typically,
yeah.
just move up there.
Yeah. They, interestingly enough, they also developed where the Prospect Hill Stock Farm was. Mm-hmm. That was developed into a housing area for less elaborate houses,
right. But
they were sold quite reasonably, and one of the big selling points of them was, of course, they're up on a hill, and that you could buy these lots quite cheaply, and they were above the fog line, because Franklin could be pretty well covered in fog with the river and the creek
and
here,
the creek.
You know, early in the morning.
Well, you want to be above that fog line.
Particularly
if you have arthritis.
That was a selling point for them, yeah.
Right. Charles Miller was very active in his church, the Great Baptist Church.
He was very active in the First Baptist Church of Franklin. He supported it. They even have a stained glass window with his photo in it. And he didn't authorize that. So it was authorized by others in the church. But it is interesting, you know. But he did much for that. He was also, I mean, we can trace so many of the Franklin industries back to him. It was not only, he knew all the railroad people in the country. He, as I said, he was a super salesman, and he would go there where the Union Pacific was having trial runs to figure out which oil to use or lubricant to use on the railroads. They had a fire test, and if you could go, however, which one could go the most miles without catching on fire, that was the criteria.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Galena Oil won hands down, except, it is interestingly enough, for a company in Cleveland, Ohio, then it was never identified as to who they were. But they could also go that far, but their oil cost about twice as much as his. So, so he won over until Galena Oil was used in about 95% of the railroads in the United States, Canada, and Mexico.
Yes.
And he had a crew of salesmen that he brought in every year to Franklin. And they would get a pep talk and be treated and wined and dined or whatever, you know. And they would go out with their kits and so forth to go sell their oil to the railroads. And it, but because of these contacts, he knew so many people in the country. And he brought in what eventually became the Chicago Pneumatic Tool Company. It was the Grant Tool Works and the Chicago Pneumatic, and they merged, and he brought those in. He brought in Coburn Manufacturing from Cleveland, and Coburn stayed here through World War One, and in the early 20s it closed. But when Joseph Joy wanted a place to move from Indiana, he went to Coburn in Cleveland and asked him if he would support him in a move. He said, yes, go to Franklin and open that building I have there and you can have it.
Hmm.
So that's how Joy Manufacturing, which is still a major employer, came to Franklin.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's really fascinating.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of links to Charles Miller.
Yes.
And when there was a process developed where you could make carbon copies. We take these things so for granted today that you remember how they used to make carbon copies and notepads? Okay. When that process was developed, he persuaded those people to come here and open General Manifold, a printing company, which stayed here for, well, till about 15 years after World War II, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all kinds of links to General Miller. He was a promoter and he knew how to. He loved Franklin. He also built his own railroad in Franklin.
Yeah,
the Jamestown Franklin Clearfield Railroad.
That's the big bridge going across the river. Right?
Yeah, the big railroad bridge that goes across at Belmar, which is now part of the bike trail.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Boy, you can't forget the Belmar Bridge if you're ever out in the middle of it.
No, so that's for sure.
I can't make it all the way across. I can tell you that right now. My wife has to lead me. It's so high.
Yeah.
And I think of him every time.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Well, Charles' brother-in-law, Joseph Sibley, had his own historical story, if you will, although, of course, they were very close, nonetheless. Was Joseph Sibley's wife Charles Miller's sister? How'd that work?
Joseph Sibley was a brother of General Miller's wife.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Sibley's kind of an independent character within the Galena operation.
Yeah.
The signal oil was actually manufactured in the Galena factory, the old Samuel Gale property. I believe he was the first one approached. I'm not sure of this, you can tell me, by John D. Archibald, Standard Oil rep. Standard Oil wanted to buy both of those concerns.
You're right, yeah.
I believe Sibley agreed first. Actually, Miller never really did agree. Am I right on that?
I'm not positive. Anyway, they bought out three of the stockholders and became the controlling interest. But, you know, Miller and Sibley kept their own stock, and Miller was hired on to run the company.
Yeah.
The original reports, which came out in one of, not the main weekly paper, but one of the smaller weekly papers, said that they agreed to pay Miller $10,000 a year to run it, which was pretty, you know, a lot of change in those days. But also he was a major stockholder, and they kind of gave him free rein, although Archibald and some of the Standard Oil people were on the board. Most of this stuff does not show up in deed transfers or anything. It only shows up in the charter books at the courthouse.
Yeah.
So you have to go explore the charter books, and then, but you don't find it in deed transfers, you know. I was naive enough at one time to think I could go to the courthouse and find out what all Standard Oil owned, and found out you couldn't do that. It wasn't possible, you know. So you have to go to the charter books and go back from there.
Of course, there were other oil men in Franklin.
We
could just keep going on and on, but let's lead to the eclipse.
Okay.
I'm going to start by Dr. Albert Egbert, who ended up living here in Franklin in the early part of the decade of the 1870s. I'm not sure just when he moved here.
I think in the 1860s he probably moved here.
He moved into the house
next door to this one. Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
His success was up at on Oil Creek at the, I call it the Egbert and Hyde farm.
Right.
Very successful as a producer.
Mm-hmm.
And with that great success, he invested.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of these investments were made out of Franklin and into some Franklin activity. Mm-hmm. You want to kind of take off on that?
Well, the producers in 1872 decided that they needed to have their own refinery. They needed a place to sell their oil. And, of course, this was Franklin Heavy Crude. The first Franklin Heavy Crude sold from $25 to $30 a barrel. But by this time, it was down to about $5 a barrel. And then it went even lower than that. So they decided they'd bring in a man by the name of Dr. Tweddle, T-W-E-D-D-L-E, mm-hmm. who was from England. And he had a process for turning, you know, oil into lubricants and so, and various other things. So they hired him, and they bought an 8-acre tract of land on a Smith farm, which is just north of Franklin, between Franklin and Old City, to put in a refinery. Now, Dr. Tweddle had a lot of smarts as far as the machinery and things he needed, and that was his investment in this. The producers were investing their oil in this. They never did have enough capital to get off the ground, but many of the producers in Franklin, including Dr. Egbert, the McCalmonts, Grants, Fee, who lived out at the very edge of the Franklin Heavy Crude Field in a little place called Galloway, decided they would, you know, put their oil in this investment. But they never had a lot of capital in back of them, and they weren't really particularly swift as far as running a refinery. Mm-hmm. And they found out that Dr. Tweddle wasn't either. I mean, he knew the process, and he knew how to do it, but they weren't in business more than a couple years before they were into bankruptcy. After Dr. Tweddle left and went to Russia, and he was going to start a refinery there, well, they hired a banker by the name of Ian Patterson. And he came on board, and he got it a little bit more financially sound, but he also didn't know much about refining. So they hired P.R. Gray, who was a former sheriff, but he also had a little refinery called the Amber Refining Company, which was bought by Standard Oil and closed. So they put him on board. Well, they still had to go for bankruptcy. And about 9 months after bankruptcy, it was sold to Standard Oil. And Standard Oil kept P.R. Gray on as their manager. Mm-hmm. And if Standard Oil hadn't bought it, I think it just would have probably faded away. Mm-hmm. But they bought it, and there was a lot of land there, and they knew that they could expand and develop it, and that's what they did. Mm-hmm. And they ended up by having about 125 acres there, you mm-hmm. know. So mm-hmm. it was constant expansion.
Mm-hmm. For younger people that, and even I didn't come here until 12 years ago or so, you really have to look at the old photos of the Eclipse site.
Oh, yeah.
It went all the way up to Tumal Run, mm-hmm. Or the OMG mm-hmm. area. People
right.
might be familiar with mm-hmm. that. Or just beyond, what is that, just beyond Burger King. This was a huge, huge facility.
Mm-hmm.
I recall, certainly the largest one in the oil region, and it may have only been second to the Atlantic Refinery in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
It was
yeah.
a big,
mm-hmm.
big.
At one time, it was called the largest in the, and actually it was carried the Atlantic name through practically all of its history because Standard Oil also owned Atlantic,
mm-hmm.
and it and then after the breakup of the Standard Oil Trust, it became strictly Atlantic. But then before that, it was always called Atlantic. It was the Eclipse Works of the Atlantic Refining Company in it, but they made some 125 products during the course of their life, 80-year span,
mm-hmm.
and they made every product known to that you could make from petroleum at that time. You know, eventually, of course, they went from lubricants, they went into gasoline, carried many names, several names that they used. You know,
different brand names,
right. and so forth.
Right.
You know, and paraffin was a big thing because our oil is paraffin based. And they made a lot of wax. A lot of it was shipped overseas. And,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you recall the name S.C. Lewis?
Oh, sure.
Could you mm-hmm. tell us a bit more about it?
Well, S.C. Lewis was the plant manager at Eclipse for many years. And he lived in Franklin. And he was just a man that was brought here by Standard Oil. And one of the things is that their people that they brought in to run it all lived here in Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he lived here for many years. He was a kind of a world traveler, brought back many interesting things from his travels, you know, cheered him with Franklin people.
I understand his first wife died.
Yes.
And to honor her, he put in one of those beautiful windows they have over
yeah.
at St. John's
right.
Church.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I, course, our audience won't be able to see this today, but I've had the pleasure of looking at that.
Oh,
just
yeah.
Wonderful.
Oh,
just
yeah.
Beautiful.
They have a full array of Tiffany windows in their church, and most of them can be traced back as memorials given by people that were in one way or another involved in the oil business. It's hard to tell who is directly involved and where the spinoffs are, but you know, many of them were people that were involved in the oil business in one way or another.
And you were telling me in a conversation earlier that the eclipse plan itself, much has gone, a few big concrete forms, but the office still exists on Route 8.
Right.
Why don't you describe that to our audience.
Okay, well, the first offices for the Eclipse were in Franklin. They had them in buildings, and they kept track of things through the telegraph and later the telephone. You know, they were hooked up to the refinery. But then they built this large office building along Route 8, and it was large at the time. You know, it doesn't look so large today, but it's, and since then it's been a furniture store. Now it's offices, it's a number of offices,
right,
so forth, but the building is still there.
Right, just above the Salvation Army, for those who might be familiar with that
part of it.
Duncan McIntosh, another big name associated
with the Eclipse. McIntosh was also a man that came here with the Eclipse, and he built a large home called Glenmoy for many years, and the home still exists. It's out on Route 322, just east of Franklin.
Yeah. And big stone house.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't know who's in there now. I think the Easter Seals was there for a while.
Well,
there still be.
There's been a variety of offices and things there. It was a religious community of nuns there for a while, and but it's now a place called Turning Point, which is a facility for youth. Yeah,
yeah. Right. A beautiful place.
It is a beautiful place.
What still exists? So much is gone of the old refining industry, but what still exists are some of these houses we're talking about. The Galena Signal Building itself.
Yeah.
I think that was built around 1901, 1902.
Yeah, yeah. And that is not near the refinery. It's over in the main part of town. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we still have a lot to look at.
Yeah. One of the things, legacies, that General Miller, and in later years he was always called General Miller because he was a general in the National Guard. Mm-hmm. And he was a Civil War veteran and a great promoter of the Civil War veterans who were here in Franklin. And many of the Civil War veterans, actually including my great-grandfather, who was a Civil War veteran and probably never would have got off his farm out in Mineral Township if it hadn't been for General Miller, but he would pay their way to go to all these GAR conventions if they would guarantee they would wear their uniforms and participate in the parade. So, but one of the other legacies that he left Franklin was he had a night school, and it was started uptown in one of the buildings that still exists uptown, and later on after they built this new office building in the early 1900s, it was moved down there. And at first it was for any young men who wanted to go. Everything was paid for as long as they would show up and go and study, and then they could go get a better job. And later on it was open for women too.
So, oh, is that right?
Yeah. And I knew when I first started to work for the newspaper here, two or three people that worked in various businesses around town. One was in banking and one was in an accounting firm, and they told me that's how they got their early training and their start, you know. Mm-hmm. They were older people at that time, but that's how they learned, and you know, which was a great thing, really, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. For the town.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Eclipse and the Galena, I think, both shut down in the 1930s, am I correct on that?
The Galena was sold to Valvoline in 1931. And they hung on for into the early 1940s, and then eventually, I mean, they didn't do much. I mean, it was still just the fringe of it. The Eclipse closed in 1937. Mm-hmm. Some of the people transferred to Port Arthur, Texas. Some transferred to Philadelphia. Some retired. Some stayed on in Franklin for various other reasons.
And in fairness, it's because of the decline in the fields.
Oh, sure.
Here, right?
Decline in the fields around here. Mm-hmm. I mean, Franklin heavy crude fields were starting to play out. Now, they were still, they still segregated Franklin Heavy Crude through the Wolf's Head Refinery in Reno up until, I'm thinking it was the 70s, 1970s, and then they quit segregating it, and it ran through with all the other oil. Mm-hmm. But for a time, you know,
it was processed separately.
Yeah, it was processed separately. Mm-hmm. Pennzoil ended up by owning, but they also owned Wolf's Head at that time, and they owned most of the heavy crude fields, or a lot of the heavy crude fields, but then they quit segregating it. And,
Let's switch to River Ridge. Mm-hmm. It overlooks, it's across the river, it's up on the hill, it overlooks the old Eclipse site.
Right.
Various groups around here give tours,
tours. Oh, yeah.
Your organization, the Mango County Historical Society, does. For those who have never had a chance to visit it or see it, why don't you explain it a little bit to a larger audience, what River Ridge was about and what it looks like even today.
Well, the main house, which everybody calls a mansion, and it is quite large because it has a couple large wings on it, and it is much the same as it was when it was built, although, you know, a lot of the decor has certainly been changed because it was sold first to a group called the White Fathers, which is a Roman Catholic organization, and they had their seminary there. And then later, it belongs to a religious group called Life Ministries, which still does retreats there and so forth. But a lot of the fancy decor, of course, is gone. Mm-hmm. And it was sold off at auction, really, by the family in the 1940s. But it was Mr. Sibley's dream to have this experimental farm. And he brought in people from, he brought in a person to run his greenhouse from Holland, and he brought in stonemasons from Europe to build many of the buildings. Many of those families still live around here. They still have ties here. And it, but he did a lot of experiments on different products. And
Artichokes.
They
were known for their artichokes.
That
didn't go too well.
Artichokes were being developed as a thing that I think they thought would help diabetics or something, and but I don't think it ever really materialized. But but as I said before, I think some of the programs they did for farmers were just such a big thing for this area. I mean, one woman told me that she went out there as a little girl, and they gave them all a sack lunch, and it had a hard-boiled egg in it. She just thought that was wonderful, you know. He didn't spare any expense in doing these things. You know, he was the politician.
Yeah.
You know, Charles Miller was not really a politician in as such. I mean, he didn't run for elective office or anything. I think he was mayor at one time, but that really was more of a, you know, just a one-term thing, you know, or something. But Sibley was the politician, you know. Both, you know, and he was in Washington, D.C. for, you know, about 10 years. So.
Right, and in his time in the 19th century, early 20th century, he was famous.
Oh, yeah. They said when he went to Washington the first time that Washington saw its most elaborate sign of horse flesh because he took all these great horses with him to run his carriages. You know,
Right. I know he had a rail car. You see the siding even today. A rail car right there along the Allegheny River below his estate area, his farm, really, it's what it was. And he invited famous people to go with him. And he went to Buffalo.
He had a boat on Lake Champlain, I think.
And
there's a picture of him with McKinley, and this boat and so forth. You know, and Charles Miller had his own railroad car too. I mean, they traveled in first class when they went.
They lived well.
Yeah,
very well.
Yeah, and Charles Miller at one time owned, I think if I remember correctly, it was 3,000 acres along Kissimmee River in Florida.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. I never heard that.
Yeah. So, you know.
Good for him.
I'm sure it wasn't worth what it is today. But, you know, he got around. Yeah. And he was on the board of several different railroads, too, across the country.
Railroads are a major part of life around here.
Oh, yeah.
This is who they sold to. And they did very well. Joseph Sibley was considered Standard Oil's man politically in Washington. And he was. We won't debate that. He was.
Mm-hmm. But it was his constituency.
Exactly.
Too.
That's the point I'd like you to make.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was.
This was people around here worked for Standard Oil.
Sure they did, yeah. Whether they knew it or not, that's who they worked for. And the Eclipse had a policy of always trying to stay one step ahead of a union organization being started at the refinery, particularly the Eclipse refinery, and they paid well, you know, and they seemed to be able to do that.
This was a prosperous community from the 1860s on, may have even been before that.
It was prosperous, and it was interesting because when you go back and you read the old newspapers, you find out a lot of little things, you know, like when we would be having a downturn, you know, and so forth, and people needed work, you know, and so forth. Like people like Robert Lamberton, who started the first bank here, I mean, they were a prominent family, but they would hire people to go work on their farm or to do something, you know. Mm-hmm. A lot of these people were gentlemen farmers, and they needed people, and they needed people to build roads, and they needed this and that, you know. But every time there was a downturn, you'd see a note in the paper, and then so-and-so hired 10 or 15 or 20 people to go help to work, you know.
Right.
And all you had to do was show up and work, and you'd get paid, you know.
You touched on something that's foreign to today's mindset. These very wealthy men, they built their own roads. They built their own infrastructure.
Oh,
this wasn't municipally sponsored.
No.
They paid for it.
Yeah, they did.
It was a good place to live because of it,
no question.
Well, let's move now into the 20th century. I'm not going to let you get away with commenting on some of what you've been so much involved in. Mm-hmm. Perhaps our viewers can see some of the many different books that you have authored or worked on as a project, as an editor. You're known for this. Your background, I'm not really sure what your background is. I know you worked for the Herald for many, many years. You're the editor of the Herald.
Yeah, I started with the News Herald right out of high school.
Oh, did you? I didn't know that.
It's a simple background. Very simple.
Well, I like to write. There's no question about that. Did you come by that naturally?
I started writing when I was in eighth grade, so I guess it was probably natural.
Well, your eighth grade teacher would be proud of you. Do you remember her?
Good. Well, we had refineries started in the 20th century, too. You know, the FOCO was started. And actually,
That's one. I read about it. I hear about it. It's in your work. I know it from your work.
Right.
Truthfully, I don't know a thing about it.
The FOCO was started as a fairly small refinery, and it was out on Route 322 going west out of Franklin, just outside the city limits. It was a small refinery, and it was started to use Franklin heavy crude again. Grant was one of the producers that really made a lot of money on a place we call Point Hill, which is right outside of Franklin, and that hillside was covered with oil derricks for many, many years. They still do a little pumping up there. Don't see the derricks like you did at that time. But he was one of the people that made a good bit of money, and he was one of the backers of this FOCO. And they started, and they were using Franklin heavy crude, and it was there again. It was for a lubricant, and they thought they had a better patent, so they started that right after World War I. It kind of floundered. It went for a while and floundered. The name was changed to Franklin Creek Refining. Eventually, it was sold to Amelie. Then it was a branch of Woodco. And it existed for many years. When it was started, they thought it was an ideal location because the little road went beside it and the railroad was beside it. Well, as it grew, it became wedged in between the railroad, the creek, and the hillside. But it grew and it prospered until 1970 when they had a disastrous fire.
Terrible.
Four refinery workers and a fireman lost their life in that fire. And, of course, that was the end of that refinery. But then General Miller, after he got out of Galena, also started a little refinery. And believe it or not, it still exists today, but it's not a refinery. And he started it as the Home Oil Company. Well, he invested most of his money in it. Eventually, it finally became a part of Standard Oil bought it after his death, and then they ended up by selling it, and it was Mooney Chemical for that was sold to Mooney Chemical. But it was Saucony Vacuum Refinery, and then eventually it closed, was sold to Mooney Chemical, and now it is still OMG, I think. It's right. OMG. Right. So it's a chemical plant now, but it's out along Tumor Road.
Sure.
So it's still here, you know.
Right.
So that's another thing, really, that General Miller started.
Was involved
that,
in.
Yeah, and was involved in.
His presence is immense. We can't.
Well, yeah.
You can't say anything less than that.
No, no. He was very much a presence. It still is, really, in the community. I mean, people don't realize it today as much, I don't think, but, you know, it's still here. Mm-hmm.
Today, really, people don't remember most of what we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
When they go back, they think they're going really far back when they talk about Chicago Nomadic and Joy.
Mm-hmm.
Those companies, you were probably working for the paper when they were in their heyday. I have to imagine that.
Mm-hmm.
Chicago Nomadic had a role. They made some oil country goods. Small, portable.
They made compressors.
Compressors.
They made compressors.
Yeah.
And they made basically compressors for the oil industry, or for other things, but a lot of the compressors. And also they made a rotary drill.
Yes.
Rich Drill came here as part of Chicago Nomadic, and they made a rotary drill. There's still a few Rich Drills running around the county today, you know.
Mm-hmm. They're considered prizes for collectors.
Yeah.
What about National Supply, the old National Supply plant over there? Across the creek. Does that mean much to you? I keep running into, we all talk about oil well supply up there. And actually, that's Oil City, yes, but it's also Pittsburgh and Bradford. Mm. They had three plants.
Mm.
But they had a competitor called National Supply.
Producer Supply.
Producer Supply? Is that what it was?
Producer Supply.
Right.
Yeah. And it was started by a family named Sheasley, who were also involved as producers of oil, and they made a variety of things for the oil industry.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, it was sold to a company named Arms Franklin, and then it became a part of Joy Manufacturing Company, and it later on the plant burned.
Mm-hmm.
But in Joy, for a time, moved part of its operation out of here, but then they eventually moved it all back because they had another plant and they needed to fill it for the void after the fire. Mm-hmm. But then now it's all back here. So
now I know you. You're not a widow. I realize that. On your property, you're famous for. Over the years, you've been famous for the things you grow. How else to put it?
That was my husband's project.
Yes,
that
okay.
was my husband's project.
Okay, well.
So, anyway.
Well, your dear begotten husband, we've got to honor him somehow or other.
Okay.
People still talk about some of those projects. How about that?
Yeah.
Part of your life.
Yeah.
All right. Let's just kind of wrap this up. Is there anything you want to tell future generations about things you've learned in your life, things you've seen here in the Franklin area and in the Venango County area that you think are worth their remembering and you have a unique perspective on it that they may not pick up otherwise?
Well, of course, I think people need to know a little bit about their history, you know, regardless of what it is. You know, a lot of people do genealogy. I don't really do genealogy, but family history is very interesting. And, you know, some people want to start there. Some want to start just by learning more about their community and so forth. But I think it's important that we do know, and we learn from that. We learn that, you know, life wasn't always as we think of it now, and maybe our problems aren't as great as some of the others were, you know. Our county history is very interesting, you know, and the whole county, whether it was involved in oil or not, we had a lot of iron furnaces in the region, and they were actually our first industries, and, you know, people built these massive furnaces around the county. Some still exist, and a lot of them are pretty much in ruins, but some still exist.
Sure, that's right. We tend to forget that there was an earlier industry, the old iron furnace industry.
We did a little publication here based on a diary that a man kept, little journal. He ran a store out in a little community called Utica. Mm-hmm. We called it the year the freshet didn't come, you know. I think we have a tendency today to think that freshets were something that the oil industry invented, but freshets were an important thing. This is based back in the 1850s, you know. Mm-hmm. And they were trying to get their, or 1840s, I guess, and they were trying to get their iron ore to market, and they couldn't get it because the river didn't rise, you know. Mm-hmm. And they had to depend on rafts to take their goods down to Pittsburgh to market, you know. So.
And it's interesting, you mentioned that, like the iron industry, because if you go up to Tyonesta, they'll mm-hmm. tell you the freshet, of course, it's associated with the early timber industry.
Right,
it's all
sure.
these people who
yeah.
needed the creeks,
right,
French
yeah.
Creek, Oil
yeah.
Creek, and the river.
Right,
uh-huh, they came yeah. up with a way to raise the level of water
right.
long before the oil industry.
Oh, sure, yeah. The oil industry, I think, was noted for damming it up, particularly Oil Creek, damming Oil Creek and releasing it so they could get their oil
yes.
barges
right.
and down to the river. But it was really something that existed long before that. And it wasn't unique to this area. It existed everywhere that anybody depended on water to get their goods to market, you know. So it, and, of course, Franklin history goes back really to the French and Indian War mm-hmm. with the building of the French fort here. And then later on we had a British fort. And later on we had a...
We had three forts, right? Right.
Actually, we had four.
Four?
Fort Michel for the French... in the 1750s, and then shortly after that, in 1760, we had the British fort, Fort Venango. Mm-hmm. And then after the Revolutionary War, they built Fort Franklin, which is how Franklin got its name. The fort was named for Benjamin Franklin, mm-hmm. who never came this far west, but anyway, it was named for him. Mm-hmm. And then after that, they had the Old Garrison, which was a small fort. And actually, the Historical Society owns the site of that fort.
That's the one just off of Elk.
Yeah, just right. off of Elk. Elk
and the one up at the 13th Street Bridge crossing is
Fort Franklin.
Fort Franklin.
Fort Franklin.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was built along French Creek.
Right.
And actually, it was used for people even as far away as Meadville coming down when they expected an Indian attack mm-hmm. after the Revolutionary War. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We all assume that the transportation routes in those days were something that we can look at today and pick up, but they actually traveled in different ways than we think.
Oh, that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was the main route mm-hmm. up there at 13th Street.
Yeah, it was the main route to go, you know, west or, mm-hmm. or north, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. The Nango County Historic Society, you've been
yeah.
very active
mm-hmm.
in this
yeah.
many years.
Mm-hmm.
Some people... You and Rainey Lindy kind of associate with this.
Yeah.
You two are the personification mm-hmm. of this. Like every historical society, it seems, you have your accomplishments, and yet we're always behind the eight ball with these local county
yeah.
historical societies.
Mm-hmm.
Never have enough money to keep
oh,
them
alive.
Oh, that's
true. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This house was a miracle.
Yeah.
A
mm-hmm. We bought it in 1981. It was for sale. It was right near the square, and it was a good... place to locate, yeah,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. yeah,
mm-hmm.
and did a lot of renovation on it, mostly just cosmetic, you know, we had to change wallpaper to get historic and things like that, so.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you have been very much involved with others in the Historical
yeah.
Society
oh, yeah.
in these more recent editions of the Venango County Histories.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic amount of work.
There, I mean, you know, it's a labor of love or you wouldn't do it. I mean, you
yes.
don't count your hours.
Or not,
no, no, I love to do research. And it's, you know, and as I said, the newspapers are a great source. If we just had time to spend all our time in microfilm, you know, we'd have a great, you know,
yes.
great
yes.
resource, you know.
Now, this group, this historic site, does have, you have a climate control.
We have a climate control archives. Actually, it's the old garage
mm-hmm.
that was on the property. There's a little office in front, and then we have climate control storage in back of it. And we do all our papers and photos in there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you've undertaken quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Then.
Yeah.
And I do think that people should realize that if they don't support these local historical society. It's just not going
to
be.
No, that's true, you know. But a lot of people come to us for things. I mean, like when they were building a couple restaurants around here, they came to us for photos that they wanted to use on their walls and so forth, you know. So things are used. Plus, people come in to do a lot of research, you know, a lot of genealogy research and different things like that. So.
Let's talk, because right across the way from us is the monument to Civil War veterans. Mm-hmm. It's tough time. Franklin had, I think, in some respects, a unique history during the Civil War. The Plummer family, they were very close to President Buchanan.
Right, yeah.
And Buchanan himself was on the line when he didn't really commit to the North and didn't really commit to the South. And that seems to be the case about these families around here.
Yeah.
Don't you agree?
Well, a lot of times that's true. I mean, the paper was Democrat, of course, during the Civil War and so forth, you know. And but we got the monument over here because... I'm going to lose my voice.
Oh, sure, go ahead.
They gave away a granite shaft in Pittsburgh at a sanitary fair to the county outside of Venango that raised the most money to support, and the sanitary fair was to support the wounded veterans.
Yes.
So we got the shaft in Venango County, so they put it in the park. They had to provide money for the base of it. And Thomas Hogue, who was one of the who built this main house that we're sitting in today, he was the fundraiser that raised the most money, so that's how we got it in the park right here. There's a picture over here on the wall shows the dedication of it in 1866, which I think was the second Civil War monument put up in Pennsylvania.
Did you ever hear about James Tarr's involvement in this monument? Does that ring any bells with you?
No.
As far as financing is concerned?
You mean the Tarr Farm?
Tarr Farm, right.
No,
right.
But he probably donated.
I understand he did, and I point that out because he was just a backwoods fellow. Who did well.
Yeah.
Okay,
well,
financially well. But things didn't go too well for him after he moved to Meadville and he ran for judge and nobody voted for him. But he was involved in that too. That's kind of forgotten. A lot of these old early producers were very much involved in Franklin. In ways we forget. The banks, a lot of them, McClintock was involved in that bank. Those fellows from Rouseville, they came down here. The exchange, all those, the exchange bank, the exchange building, all those things we call the exchange hotel.
Right. Mitchell.
That was, Mitchell, right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, we had a lot of involvement, you know, with oil money. I mean, people would spend it and so forth, you know, so...
And we tend to forget that today. And
I
must tell you, I have to remind people from Franklin from time to time, yes, this is an oil town.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't just Oil City or Thomasville. This is an oil community.
Yeah, and of course the fact, I think, that we were established and had the courthouse here was important, you know. And of course we got a new courthouse because of the oil boom.
Right, exactly. It wasn't big enough to handle all that those
when they built the second courthouse in the 1840s, they thought it would last forever. And it turned out that, you know, it didn't last 20 years because they needed more room right away, you know. And they had to have a fireproof building, so.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Carolee. I realize this is an hour... event does get to be a little challenging sometimes.
I'm losing my voice, that's
and
all.
I will, yes, I know you are.
Okay.
But you've put up with us, and it's certainly...
No, I've enjoyed it. I mean, I love to talk about history, so,
Well, look, let's have more of these conversations.
Okay.
Hey, we'll bring you back for another version of Carolee Mischner.
Okay.
Whatever.
Right.
We've been talking with Mrs. Carolee Mischner again, November 14th, 2008. It's in the city of Franklin, and it's certainly always a pleasure to speak with you, and it's really been an honor, and I certainly hope in generations to come they appreciate the role you've played in life around here. You were highly regarded and highly respected.
Okay.
Thank you very
okay.
much.
Thank you, Neil.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.